Today, we have an interview with Matthew Eich of U.S. Energy.
This is Jerry Toome of Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing. The following is an interview with Matthew Eich of U.S. Energy discussing the outlook for oil and other energy sources. This interview was recorded in December of 2023, but the topics covered are still very applicable to today. We hope you enjoy the interview. Now to Jerry Toome and Matthew Eich.
Today we have another guest, Matthew Eich. He's Executive Vice President of U.S. Energy, one of our longtime friends, and he's now in the West Texas oil patch. He used to be in Pennsylvania years ago, but I think he likes things in Texas a lot better.
I do.
Matthew, it seems like if you look at our culture, the whole world's turned against oil and gas investing as if it's Darth Vader and the evil empire. Despite political pressure, left-wing environmentalists, at least so far, renewable energy in the form of solar and wind have barely scratched the surface for the demand needs of the world in terms of energy. I just saw recently that the U.S. energy, 60% is produced by fossil fuel of the electricity. Wind is 10% and solar 3% of electricity. So the bottom line is oil demand is continuing to ratchet up. The International Energy Agency estimates final demand for oil in 2023 will increase by 2.3 million barrels a day right now. And to give you some reference point, folks, 102 million barrels of oil increasing by 2.3 million. That's a lot of oil increase, and we'll talk about a little bit more about that later. But what I see is the demand growth, because we're going to talk about supply as well, the demand growth continues to come from emerging markets. Primarily, the big dogs in that are China and India. Those people are hell-bent on driving cars, advancing into the 21st century. Matter of fact, the latest statistics from Alpine Macro, India's oil demand is expected to rise by 6% this year alone. What do you see out there? I know you know a lot about oil and gas, and you have your own insights. What are your inputs to support or maybe contradict any of these facts?
So that's a lot to unpack in the early part of the conversation, right? So the Darth Vader part, I love that point. My kids used to laugh knowing that I was in the oil and gas business because every movie they saw as children, from The Muppets to Cars, the bad guy was always the oil guy. So I think as an industry, we've ironically been really bad at letting people know that the engine for all of advancement in the last 150 years has come from energy. Cheap, abundant energy, from whether the clothes we wear to the lifestyles we live. It is the single greatest source of health, maintenance, and all the benefits of society that we see. So I think we're just bad as an industry. We need to get rid of that Darth Vader.
Bad in terms of your reputation.
Yeah, horrible in terms of reputation.
Trying to defend yourself.
You know, but when you really think about it, when you talk about, you know, global poverty and the need for medicine, and abundant energy is ultimately the solution for the world to have a better standard of living. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why we're not seen as the saviors. And I think it's just because we make money. So we must be bad because there's profit involved. So I'll throw that part out. But your stats and all your points are really accurate and have a lot of merit. So just looking at the global population issue in terms of the growth of consumption, and you crossed over 8 billion humans on the planet last year. 8 billion. Do you remember when it was 3 billion and everyone was thinking it was crazy? And that was 10 years ago.
Oh, the world's overpopulated and we're all going to die by the year 2000, according to Paul Ehrlich, I think.
Anyway. So, no, it's true. And we're going to cross 10.5 billion. And you mentioned it. It's not just China and India. It's really Africa that's going to be a big contribution to that growth. So, when you look at the global population and consumption, and you think about the U.S. and its 330 million humans here in the U.S. and how much energy we consume, and the 1.2 billion in China, India, and when you really start to do the math behind it, that 2% growth you're talking about in consumption is really minor. And the only reason that we haven't had significantly greater than 2% growth globally is one, there's a scarcity of energy. How much is actually there? Hmm. And there's a competition for it.
Mm-hmm.
So you need money,
right?
And then unfortunately, some people get priced out because it's too expensive. So you think about this from a global standpoint, and this is the really scary statistics. So we put $5 trillion in renewables in the last several years. $5
trillion. $5 trillion sounds like a big number.
It's a big number. We've gone from 3% renewables to 4% renewables on $5 trillion.
3 to 4?
3 to 4% of energy.
Oh, that's going to cure the world's ills. Everything will be magic.
The dollars that theoretically could happen, and then you take about the rare earth elements and the resource, it just can't happen. But the goal, the real goal that no one wants to talk about, because I guess there's sides. I don't think there's sides. There's political sides, I guess, in the U.S.
Right.
But there's no sides in energy. The reality is, if you keep growing at 2 to 3%, the growth of consumption should be handled by renewables.
Okay.
So you can't go from 102 to 104 to 106 to 110 million barrels a day. That's just a couple years away.
Right.
Globally, we can only produce, we think, about 105.
Okay.
Maximum capacity, Saudi Arabia, Iran, no sanctions, Russia, the U.S., everyone in full capacity, maybe 105, 106 million barrels a day.
Mm-hmm.
You're 2.5 years from that. So you need renewables to meet this 2% growth.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, renewables are actually handling less than half the growth.
Mm.
They can't handle half the growth. They're not replacing any of the base load.
Right.
Zero. Just the growth in consumption.
So they're not even replacing that. The base of what we're using now, they're not even replacing half of the growth.
They're not even replacing half of the growth. So when you really think about the statistics, yes, energy, fossil fuels are going to be needed. No matter whether you trust the EIA or you think they're a leftist propaganda, or it doesn't matter. Everyone, even under carbon neutral plans, you're going to consume more carbon. The goal is, can you sequester it? Can you find ways to negate it? But the reality is you need more fossil fuels. And for a global uplift in how we want to live, you absolutely need more energy.
Have to fight the global poverty issue. So those are good facts. You know, I've seen some facts from firms like the EIA, which I think you mentioned might be a little bit on the left-wing side, but that's okay. They still expect, in spite of what we're talking about here, they still expect that by 2030, about 80% of the world's energy comes from fossil fuels still. Now, this may be a lowball number, but 70% of the world's energy needs by 2050. Is that what you're seeing?
So I think those are optimistic best-case scenarios,
okay,
which is sad.
Right.
Right. So that's the we'll call it the left-wing propaganda hopes.
Okay.
That you can get to 70% of consumption being fossil fuels. I think the reality is, if the current curve that we're looking at, you're still talking 90% of the global energy consumption. The problem really becomes oil and gas don't really factor into the problem. The coal factors into the problem.
Right.
Can you start using clean coal? And can we go back to nuclear? Because that is a real solution.
True.
No one wants the NIMBY issue, not in my backyard. But the reality is, especially if you want to electrify stuff, and electrifying is really good for things like cities. You get rid of smog, create some efficiencies. Mm-hmm. It's not efficient in terms of energy density.
Right.
But the only way to really do that is to add things like nuclear. Otherwise, you're going to see what is happening in China happen around the world, where every couple of days, they're putting on a new coal plant. Mm-hmm. So for the last several years, about every 3 days or 11 days, depending on the statistics you want to look at, they put on a new coal-fired plant goes on board to create solar panels that they sell to us, and that they put more carbon in the atmosphere that they'll ever recapture. It's a sad little game,
right.
But the reality is, and if you even think about the EVs and all the use, you have to use more oil to create an EV than you do in a traditional ICE vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So even to make a conversion, you have to almost double down on the amount of oil consumption by 2050. So it would actually be 95 or 100%. People don't really to actually get to where the goals would be, you'd consume more. Even though over the next 50 years after that, you consume less, you'd consume more in the next 30 years to try to get to that goal.
And most people don't have a 30-year investment horizons right now that are listening to our show either. Yeah, so and that's one thing that I think is grossly overlooked in the media is the fact that, well, I know Germany, as far as I know, most recent stats, gets most of their electricity from coal. China gets most of their electricity from coal. Coal is by far and away the dirtiest of all of the methods of producing electricity. Yet all we hear from the media is what they want us to hear, almost, I don't want to say propaganda, because that makes it sound like it's a conspiracy theory, but maybe it is a little bit, you know. But the bottom line is, who cares? If, okay, China is leading the world in terms of electronic vehicle, you know, adoption. Mm-hmm. And they're huge. I mean, and that's something we want to talk about in a minute in terms of security, global security for energy. But the bottom line is, yeah, but they're producing, where are they getting electricity from in the first place?
Yeah.
Most of it's coming from coal, and that's the dirtiest of all pollutants. So anyway, don't get me on my soapbox. I might get too unhappy.
I'll join you on the soapbox.
That's right. Okay, let's talk about supply for a minute. Talking about supply, to cushion the world economy from an oil shock when Russia invaded Ukraine, President Biden liquidated as much as 40%. Now, this is interesting, folks. Biden liquidated as much as 40% of the U.S. petroleum reserve. That's 250 million barrels. Has taken our stockpile down to the lowest levels for the reserve since the early 1980s. Now, I think personally, and I'm not predicting anything necessarily is going to happen in the Middle East, but at the same time, I think the international oil markets are way too complacent about the geopolitical risks here. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see Putin try to turn over the apple cart, so to speak, prior to next year's election in an attempt to try and get Biden kicked out of office. He's clearly not in Biden's camp. He wants to eliminate Biden if he can. And bank credit analysts have stated that 9 out of the last 10 recessions have been preceded by spikes in oil prices. What do you think is going to happen here?
I think you ask questions that have so much to unpack in each one of those questions. So if I try to break each of them down, I can go in reverse or I can kind of go where you started. But the Middle East is scary.
Right.
I'm going to try to put my head in the sand a little bit and hope that things don't.
Right. Escalate.
Escalate at all, because ultimately the price side risk is huge. So I'm going to start back to the problem that you first mentioned. Emptying the strategic reserves was good for inflation.
Right.
Right. It was politically expedient. It was a good idea. The problem becomes it's meant for wartime. And if you get into a supply side shock, which we're sitting here facing between, especially if Iran gets involved.
Right.
We are in a spot where we can't enforce the sanctions against Iran because we need their 3 million barrels a day. Mm. If their 3 million barrels a day weren't being sold right now, you'd already have $120 oil.
Right.
So we're in a really bad spot where we lose our stick.
Right.
When it comes to things like this because of the strategic, but we also had an inflation problem. So I get the drama.
Right.
But it's really scary because the OECD also has very low inventory. And today, when you talk about 26 days of inventory and no inventory here in the U.S., the problem becomes you have no cushion left.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I always say, imagine sitting on a park bench that has a nice soft cushion normally, and some shock happens. You get a $10, $15 price swing. It's white noise. It comes up. It comes back down.
Mm-hmm.
When you have no cushion and you sit on that park bench, it hurts.
Right.
So shocks can be significantly greater.
Right.
If you have no excess capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Because then the only way to stop people from consuming is to price them out of the market.
Right.
And if you look backwards in time and what we need from a price scenario on an inflation-adjusted price to price people out of the market, it's more than people think. Because everyone thinks $100 oil is expensive.
Right.
But if you take that inflation-adjusted, we're at 50. Right, people don't get the concept that oil prices aren't 100 isn't high anymore. 100 is the new 50.
Mm.
So when people go and they realize what does it actually have to. So and I'll give it to the U.S. consumer standpoint. Our pocketbooks are less than 3.2% on our fuel.
Mm-hmm.
It's historically 4.6%. So you'd still have to get much higher pricing for us to actually feel our pocketbook.
Mm-hmm.
Even though mentally we hate paying $100 to fill up our tank, the reality is it's 150. So the real price shock would have to be above 140, 150 to have that kind of, to in essence, shock the market.
To cut the demand.
I don't want to see oil anywhere near that.
Right.
Everyone think as an oil company, we love high prices. No, it creates a lot of negativity.
Well, your costs go up.
Your margins don't go up necessarily, right? They do on older stuff. But the new stuff you do costs more. So actually what goes up is your risk.
Right.
Right. Not necessarily, yes, everyone thinks that it's great that you're selling it for more. I actually see it as the opposite, which is, you know, does that cause a recession, which is what you just mentioned, right?
Exactly, which then pulls the price back down later
on. I'd rather have a lot more stability and consistency and market growth rather than having that seesaw.
Rather than having a big spike and then a big crash.
So I prefer to put my head in the sand, and I'm going to pray for not just the humanitarian side.
Oh, for sure.
But for the impact on the global economy that doesn't happen, because it is severe.
It is. And it's, as we're talking about that, the geopolitical risk, I've seen estimates as much as 30. Everybody says 30%, but in some cases, as much as 50% of the world's oil supply could be in jeopardy if that war between Israel and Hamas spills out. So hopefully we don't see that happen. But gosh, these are the kind of things you have to be careful about. So
yeah, and I think the Saudis have been a really good moderating force.
Mm-hmm.
We made a huge political mistake in making them our enemy.
Okay.
because they're the one moderating force in the Middle East that, if they're working with us, can really help reduce prices, because they're the only lever left on supply.
They're the only real potential. They can increase their supply a bit.
Yeah, a couple million barrels a day, yeah. And that really is the moderating force. Not against a major supply side shock, but Iran's offset. If we sanction Iran again, Saudi Arabia can ramp back up about the same that we sanction them.
Right.
So that's a big impact.
To keep oil from going to $250
a barrel. It can't stop. You know, something spilling out in a war, or Saudi Arabia couldn't solve that problem, right? If you just shut down 30% of supply, the world's going to have havoc, massive. Right? But they can stop some of those shocks. That's why politically we've made an enemy out of someone we needed to be our friend, right? And now they're siding with China and Russia, which is really problematic for our country, because we need that friend in the Middle East right now, especially when it comes to oil.
Good point. We know that, as the old saying goes in the securities industry, past performance no guarantee of future results. But I've seen Morgan Stanley recently said that oil has had a very discernible 12-year cycle. I went back and looked at the numbers. I said, hey, this is accurate. We saw the oil prices top, and I remember this back when I first got in the industry, I guess I'd been in the industry 5 or 6 years. 1986, we saw a top in the oil price, and then oil bottomed in 1998, about 12 years later-ish. The 1998 bottom, we saw a bull market in oil until about 2010, and these are all approximates, but they're pretty close on the dates. That was the next top. Then oil prices were under pressure until the COVID bottom in 2020, when they actually went negative, when some bank in China apparently didn't understand how to deal with the futures market. Anyway, the way it looks like it's stacking up, and I know you just said you don't want to see oil prices go way too high because it creates havoc, but it looks to me like we could see oil prices possibly not topping until 2032, if the 12-year thing continues, 12-year cycle. Any comments you have on that?
Yeah, so I love Morgan Stanley's research. Goldman Sachs has very similar findings, and a lot of the major banks that look at the data. And I think the energy super cycle thesis is a pretty accurate one. So take out all the white noise that we just talked about.
Right.
All the geopolitical stuff.
Right.
And just focus on macro economics, supply, demand side, not all the stuff that can happen in between.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that we're in the very early innings of a super cycle. Right. So you're going to see spikes all around it,
right?
Up, down, sideways. Oil
you'll
is
see the noise.
It's the most heavily traded commodity.
And it's leveraged in the futures market, so it's going to swing a lot.
Yeah. And there is a possibility of that changing, of getting either more or less volatile, which is a whole sidebar conversation about the majors aren't really hedging anymore because they don't have debt.
Hmm.
And if they don't use hedging and there's less volume in hedging, then do you have more volatility or less if it's not is actively traded? It's a really interesting that, is it all done by market makers then and not actually by companies looking to hedge? It'll be a really interesting dynamic. If the majors don't have any debt, that's a massive amount of hedging that comes off the market. So whole sidebar conversation that we won't.
All right.
But at the end of the day, yeah, I think that you have this global issue. When we look out at 2032 and where that trend kind of comes, I think
the energy super cycle.
The energy, I think COVID delayed it by about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, China, because seriously, their slow rollout has kept pressure on demand being lower than anticipated.
Okay.
Because their economy really hasn't come back. A bunch of COVID screw-ups, and then now they're just not in the same spot, which is fortunate for all of us, because if demand is down, then it keeps a lid on price.
Right.
So we've been really fortunate, and the U.S. dollar has been so strong that it continues to put downward pressure on price. Those are good things, ironically, for lower prices.
Right.
So
for U.S. consumer.
Yeah. So I think it's actually delayed this 12 to maybe a 15-year cycle of this trend of energy, especially oil, becoming more and more expensive over that period of time. Now, I don't think it's a straight upward move, as we talked about. Volatility up and down. But I think you're in a cycle where you start to get more of an inflation-adjusted price.
Mm-hmm.
What'll be super interesting is at what point in the U.S.'s cycle does natural gas come to kind of parity with oil?
Yeah.
Does LNG exports in 2027 and 2026 start to make U.S. natural gas price trade similar to oil price? So if the new oil price is 100 and then 105, then 110, then 115, and it goes up and up and up on a rope, even though a ton of volatility around it.
Right.
The question is, at what point does natural gas trade equivalent? So natural gas should trade around 6 BTUs, like the differential of energy equivalency is 6 to 1.
Okay.
So what means is that $2 an MCF is uber cheap at $100 oil.
Right.
At $100 oil, natural gas should be $9, $10 an MCF.
Hmm.
That's the equivalency here in the U.S. for the two, because ultimately, if the energy density is 6 to 1, it's really simple. That's what the price should be, because it should be about energy density and ultimately not just pricing. But currently, it's about supply and demand. And since the U.S. has so much natural gas supply,
right,
and every time we drill more oil, we get more and more gas,
right,
which means if too much supply domestically, it's going to keep a cap very low on prices for the next several years.
Right.
So I do think there's a really interesting dynamic that we'll talk about maybe in 2026. Why is natural gas gone from a base of 2 to 5 or 6? And why is it now 9 versus 2? I think you're several years away from it, but it really comes to, is the U.S. going to be a net exporter? And is it going to produce enough globally that it gets a little bit more parity in pricing? But I think it'll follow the same trend globally. If you exclude the U.S.
Right.
from this conversation, natural gas is going to have a similar trend that oil has. And I think it'll trade around 6 to 1 in terms of its energy. So you'll see globally $100 oil, $9 MCF gas, which you see currently now everywhere but the U.S.
That makes sense. Because as we drill and we got pipeline developments in America that are pretty prolific, and you know, as you said, you drill more and more oil, you can keep finding more and more gas. So makes a lot of sense. Looking at the longer term future for oil and gas, setting aside any wishful thinking from the far left, I like to pick on them occasionally. It's John Criswell, our old host, said, "Well, it's so fun. There's such a great target to pick on." I'm like, okay. Well, anyway, he was a media guy, news media. Everything seems to be in sync for demand to continue growing for the foreseeable future. We mentioned earlier countries like China and India. Yet far fewer U.S. projects are being funded by the United States. I saw this in some of your material recently, and I was astounded. They said new discoveries have fallen. This is pretty astounding, folks. New discoveries of new oil patches, if you will, have fallen 90% from their peak in 2006. Wow. Now, the major oil companies right now are being pressured politically and by Wall Street. They're investing less and less in new drilling programs. So last year, for the first time in U.S. history, the major oil companies, publicly traded companies in America, put more money into buying back company stock and paying cash dividends than they did in drilling for new oil wells. It seems to me the far left is painting us into a dangerous corner here. As we mentioned earlier, solar, wind, and other renewables are nowhere near ready to take over to supply the world's energy needs, while emerging markets like China and India keep ramping up demand. My goodness, even I noticed some stats from another firm. They said almost a complete collapse in petroleum enrollment in U.S. colleges. How do we get out of this without having what looks like to me could be a major crisis before the end of the decade, pushing prices a lot higher?
I don't know if you do. So you do have a problem on so many fronts, right? So the next generation is always supposed to be the solution. And instead of making ICE engines better, instead of bringing out new petroleum engineers to create the next technology advance that shifted the industry 5 years ago with horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, right?
Right.
The next technology, the generations are older. I can tell you just hiring people in the space, it's very interesting. I think one of the things is maybe we need to get the image out a little bit better.
Right.
That whole, to save the world, you need more efficiency and energy. Come work in this sector as a public good. Right? It's almost the same as saying, why do people work at the CIA? They know it's a public good.
Right.
Right. They know, is it the highest paying? Is it the most rewarding? Do you sometimes have to do stuff you don't love? By the end of the day, it's a social function that we need people to do. I think in petroleum engineering, I think in oil and gas, the U.S. needs to be the leader, because the rest of the world would love to have scarcity in supply. Right?
Yeah.
They would love it so that they could control price, and they in the world's worst actors. The worst actors control the most volume, right?
Of course.
It's horrible. Iran, Iraq, China, Russia. Like, you just look at the scenario. It's really scary. Energy, whether you're talking about solar and renewable or you talk about oil and gas, the world's worst actors are controlling the supply side. That's a really scary scenario to be in. So I almost think it's a narrative that we need to create here in the U.S., that it is one of the greatest things the U.S. has to do is be the energy leader of all things. Stop making it so political that it's this versus this. It's all of them.
Right.
All the technologies, nuclear, wind, solar, all renewables, all biodiesels, all oil and gas. They're all phenomenal. And we need to create more efficiency. I mean, we have reduced our carbon output by so much. It is such an insane scenario for the U.S. to talk about how much consumption we have and how little carbon output we have, right? It's crazy what we're able to do. We basically have fuel additives now that you can make an ICE engine that has zero carbon output. It's crazy what we do, and yet we're focusing on all other stuff, right? Yeah. So I don't know how we get that mindset into the younger generation. Mm-hmm. I think in the South we have a little bit better shot.
Yeah.
To maybe push that forward, as horrible as that sounds.
Right.
I think the universities tend to go the exact opposite way. So
yeah.
you have.
Yeah.
But Wall Street has really forced on top of politically.
Right.
Wall Street has forced oil companies into a very good thing economically for investors.
Right.
Very bad for our future.
Exactly.
So by all the profits that we're forcing them to maintain and not focus anything on R&D, research mm-hmm. and development. So it used to be, as an oil company, if you could replace your reserves, they call it a recycle ratio. As long as I was making money and growing my reserves, my stock price would go up. So mm-hmm. as a CEO, my job would have been, hey, get my stock price up.
Right.
So ultimately, I'd buy a lot of land, do a lot of R&D, prove out stuff so that my stock price would go higher. Now you get punished. If you don't operate within cash flow, if you're not super efficient with every dollar, if you're not focused on zero R&D, your stock price goes down. Hmm. So ultimately, you're actually now relying on not the majors, mm-hmm. other companies to innovate.
The independents.
And the independents don't have the financial resources to right. innovate like yeah. the majors. So
exactly.
the whole world has benefited from the U.S.
Right.
and our ability to get fossil fuels in efficient ways. We've been the leader. We've been all of it. You take away the R&D side of it, mm-hmm. that's really bad for all of us. Now, the one thing I will tell you, though, is you watch the majors and how efficient they've become with every dollar they spend in the field, mm-hmm. and every dollar they spend is more efficient than it was 3 years ago. So yeah, they true. Are getting better in right. those ways. The right. efficiencies are insane. I wish it was still on the R&D side as well and, uh-huh. and finding new reserves. There will be reserves. The question will be at what price.
Yeah.
So there's oil to drill.
Right.
That breaks even at $95 a barrel. Mm-hmm. You probably remember a lot of those, right? So 5-7 years ago, people were drilling those areas that broke even at much higher prices, not $30, $40, $50 a barrel, but $90 a barrel. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be reserves. It's at what price.
Right.
So unless we focus on R&D, you're just going to have much higher pricing
yeah.
to justify the activity behind it.
Yeah, and the efficiencies, of course, can bring the cost down, but that requires capital to go into it in order to keep pushing the efficiency so that you can keep pushing the price down. So
no, selfishly, it's ironic. We have benefited as a private company uh-huh. from the lack of capital going into the oil and gas space. It's been our biggest benefit. Mm-hmm. As horrible as that sounds, that void, it's still a void, right? Pensions, endowments, Harvard, Yale, they all divested of oil and gas.
I know.
Everyone's not putting money into it. Carbon's bad. Well, that leaves a hole where we get outsized returns that we shouldn't get for the risk that we're taking. Lowest right. risk, best returns we've ever had. And we're kind of thankful. I'm not thankful as a country. As an right. individual operator,
right.
it's awesome. This is the best time I've ever operated in. I can't believe that this opportunity continues to exist. But it's very selfish of me because that's not what's good for the country or the world or everyone else. So I kind of like that Wall Street has changed its mind and that mm-hmm. the Black Rocks of the world have forced pensions. You're starting to see it shift, though. The New York teacher's pension is being right. sued by its employees because
yeah.
it's missed out on returns. By avoiding
oil.
So you do have an issue where I think ultimately will green or green win?
Mm-hmm.
Green energy or money? And I don't know which is more powerful. Right now, green energy is actually more powerful than actual money.
Right.
Does that persist forever? Is there a reversion to the mean? We'll find out.
And the question is, of course, we're using behavioral finance. Social reality is that, hey, everybody believes oil's bad, so therefore divest from it. They're the evil empire, as we've mentioned in the show. Reality is that's not the case. So let's hope that people will wake up.
Well, that's the reality is what is the stock market, right? It's people's bet on what the future value is.
Right.
And if you think the future value of oil is zero, it doesn't matter how much money that those companies make. It doesn't right. matter how good they are, how profitable. You don't believe it's going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you, if you really believe that, why would you invest in something you think is going to be gone in 10 years?
Right.
And half the population believes.
Yeah, it's a terminal value issue.
It's the horse and buggy. They believe it's the horse and buggy to the car, and it's not. And like that analogy to me is crazy.
But the facts simply do not even get close to adding up to that. But that's, again, social reality. People believe that because people tell each other the contagion effect takes over. And, of course, confirmation bias kicks in because they want to believe that.
They want to believe it. And that's
believe
the
it.
Single biggest problem that we have in today's world is that social media compounds
right.
that confirmation bias. We yeah, only hear does. What we want to hear. We get our likes. We get a positive feedback loop, creates dopamine. We're super happy about it. Everyone loves this process, right? But it's creating a real problem where that perception people believe is reality. And it's a problem on all sides.
Yeah, and it's not even close to reality. Well, Matthew, this has been a very good interview. We've enjoyed it a lot. You brought a lot of new material out and a lot of insight into areas, since I'm not in the oil industry per se, although I do invest in that area. That's some great information. So we appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jerry Tuma Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services, an independent financial group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.